Right, I just have a couple of announcements before I'm going to turn things over to our moderator this morning. Some of these things are already in your ideologue, so I'll be brief. The session in the Marble Garden at 10:15, Memorable Events That Changed Your Life, is not going to be taking place. A key reminder, though, this afternoon session, which is going to be extraordinary, in the music tent, the program is going to begin at 1 o'clock. We expect the doors to open at about 12:45, and I'd urge you to be there as soon as possible. That event will be open to the pass holders for the first session, all of you, as well as the first event for the pass holders for the second session. And in addition, we have made tickets available to members of the public in the Roaring Fork Valley. So there'll be quite a few people there, so you should try to get there a little bit early if you can. All you need to get in is your pass. They may or may not, we understand, be handing you a physical ticket as you go in, but don't worry about that. Just have your pass with you. Before that, lunch, as always, will be in the usual places, the Greenwald Pavilion and the Pepke Tents. One other thing is we are going to be distributing program evaluations at the end of this session. Please take a few minutes to fill them out. They were enormously important to us last year as we were planning for this year. This is still only the second time we've done this, and your ideas and suggestions are incredibly important to us. Also, as this is one of the last formal gatherings, for all of you who have joined us for this first session, and we really aren't going to have an appropriate time to say goodbye and thank you with the afternoon session, I do want to, on behalf of the Aspen Institute, thank all of you for being here with us and being such extraordinarily engaged participants and questioners and colleagues over the last few days. I'd like now to introduce my friend, one of our trustees. We are very much in his debt for his ideas and spirit to a wide range of things that we do here at the Institute. Jerry Murdoch is co-founder of Insight Venture Partners and has spent much of his career investing in innovation. And so we really couldn't have a better moderator and introducer for the panel than Jerry. Jerry, all yours.
Thank you very much, Elliot. Can you guys hear me okay? Great. First of all, welcome, and thank you very much for getting up early and coming here to the panel discussion. Today we have five gentlemen who represent companies which have had an interest in innovation and what they've accomplished over time. And what I'd like to do is to ask each of them to sort of introduce themselves and tell you a little bit about yourself, just to start off. And we'll start with you. We have Chris Sacca from Google.
Hi, my name is Chris Sacca. I'm the head of special initiatives at Google, which means I'm responsible for starting new stuff, basically, for trying to maintain the culture of a startup within an increasingly bigger company. So most recently, I've started stuff like Google Wi-Fi, an effort to bring Wi-Fi to cities and inspire cities around the world to go ahead and provide access to their citizens.
That's great. Don Paul from Chevron.
Hello. Don Paul. I'm the Vice President and Chief Technology Officer for Chevron Corporation. My responsibility spans all the ranges of technology that are involved in our businesses, from exploration through product making, through IT, as well as new ventures through venture capital and our technology ventures group.
Great. John Seeley Brown.
Yeah, I, until fairly recently, was the former chief scientist of Xerox Corporation and director of its Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, and currently at USC.
Right. Sidney Harmon.
I am Sidney Harmon. I chair Harmon International. I'm a trustee with Jerry of the Institute. Harmon International manufactures what I modestly declare is the world's finest audio equipment. And we make these beautifully sophisticated digital systems for the automakers almost nobody cares about anything that I do beyond the fact that I am the number one spear carrier for the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee.
Thank you for that great introduction. Ropara?
Yeah, thank you. Ropara with Dell. I have three core responsibilities at Dell. The America's Continent Logistics and Manufacturing Operations, our Dell International Services, which are our call centers worldwide, and the home and small business sector here in the U.S.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. Today on the panel, the goal here, we're going to talk about innovation and invention in the era of globalization. I think most of us feel, particularly in this country, that innovation has been a huge part of the American success and past. I think innovation is something that's been important with all mankind. And the question is, how is it changing? How is it important? A lot of people who've experienced innovation in the workplace, some have embraced it and some have been very threatened by it. Some people say, great, innovation is fantastic as long as it doesn't happen to me. Innovation is something which I think is more and more important in today's world. And what I'd like to do is start off with these people and have them talk about their personal experience or the experience of their company that they work with. And how important is innovation, Ro, in what happens at Dell?
Dell is a 20-year-old company that was really founded on innovation, you know, with Michael Dell and his direct model. And when you think about how that was founded, it all happened because customers forced that innovation on us, an idea, a requirement. And I think today, over those 20 years, that's how innovation still happens at Dell. It is very much customer-driven, and it is a culture really built around that. All of us, from a frontline employee to Michael and Kevin Rollins, our CEO, really foster that, and it's an environment that has continued to challenge us to innovate, you know, to compete more effectively in the marketplace.
That's great. Sydney?
Robert Frost, our marvelous poet, once observed that the human mind is an astonishing instrument. Turns on automatically, he said, when we get out of bed in the morning. It does not shut off until we get to the office. On this subject, I think my job is to encourage that mind being turned on the moment it gets to the office and thereafter forever. There are two experiences in my time that particularly informed my thinking about all of this, which I regard as crucial not only in terms of product and process, but in terms of organization, in terms of epistemology, in terms of the way people connect to each other in the workplace. And in the course of this colloquy, I hope I'll have an opportunity to speak with them.
Great. Thank you. John C. Brown?
You know, when I started out running Xerox PARC, I used to think that all the great ideas would come, first of all, from within, where we're now discovering more and more of the great ideas actually come from outside our organization. We can come back to this. But we as research scientists used to think if we could create the phenomenal idea, we should be viewed as heroes, that we had done 99% of the work and everything else was just drudge work. I quickly learned that there's probably more creativity involved in taking an idea to market than creating the idea in the first place.
Yeah.
So we really need to have now a much more balanced understanding of how do you connect to the market and what is the right time and how do you make a difference in the market, as opposed to just how do you sit back here and have the play of imagination thinking wild, wonderful thoughts.
Right. As a venture capitalist, you know, we look at innovation, and our definition of is that innovation without capital is economically meaningless. You need to be able to execute on your innovation. Capital is one of the typical resources required to make it happen.
And timing is too.
Correct. Don?
Just a couple of thoughts about the energy business that's a little bit different than my distinguished colleagues here. One is the scale. Certainly for a company like Chevron that's in 180 countries. The other is time frame.
Yeah.
We've been at it about 125 years at this point. And the nature of energy is basically finding and moving and changing molecules and delivering them to where they're needed. Sometimes they get turned into electrons. But that infrastructure lasts not just decades, but generations. So innovation sits in the context of continuously improving that system. Now, there's some parts of the system where innovation, in a way, has a shorter time frame. I would argue that people involved in frontier exploration, who are trying to actually find a geological concept that people haven't found before, that's a clear invention process, probably crucial. And today, as we see the emergence of what I would call new energy systems that are going to be an essential part of the diversification of energy in the next 20 years, that has a higher invention rate, too, than the traditional one. So we kind of manage all three. One, which you've institutionalized for 100 years, which is people, geologists, trying to find where these accumulations exist. Continuous innovation to improve that supply chain end-to-end, sometimes inventing new ways to make new molecules along the way. And then today, understanding how do you take inventions and commercialize them into an infrastructure that will have the scale, scope, reliability, and longevity of the existing business.
Nice, great. And Chris, I'd like to ask you, Google obviously being a really new company, which captured the imagination of the public, with its meteoric rise out of nowhere. How do you guys look at this? Is it important?
Yeah, I mean, we consider ourselves a platform for innovation. So we have a very simple formula. It's basically take the world's smartest people, give them all the infrastructure they could ever want, sick them on the world's biggest problems, and then get the hell out of the way. And so in saying that, the world's smartest people means people who've achieved well academically, but who've also built stuff, who've been within the Silicon Valley culture, who failed before. I think nowhere more than Google we find people who have built large failures like Exodus and Excited Home and companies like that and Go Corporation that have succeeded and crashed. In terms of infrastructure, we try and run the world's largest computing network and make machines as available as possible to our engineers, so that's not a limiting factor. But even on a micro level, if an engineer needs an extra computer monitor, we give that to them. We think it's weird to pinch pennies when you're paying somebody $150,000 a year to cheapen out on a $400 monitor that might double their productivity. In terms of the world's biggest problems, we ask people to start with an end user problem first and work backwards from there into a solution. Too often people start with an existing revenue model and try and incrementally improve that revenue model and lose sight of that customer problem.
So you filter the smart people who failed a lot by having them look at the customer first. Customer is a crucial component in how you innovate your solution?
Yeah, so we try and remove reality from the equation, right? And so, and again, we also, in terms of getting out of the way, we put the lawyers across the street. And so you've got an environment in which engineers have all the resources they need to go ahead and innovate, and then and have as direct a connection as possible to an end user problem and start from that. Sometimes great products result that may not have any business model, but they've advanced the cause of the end user. Other times they end up being things that do $8.5 billion annualized.
Yeah, years ago at Dell, I know Michael Dell talked about the customer being a very important part of your equation for innovation. Is that still the case today?
It is. Although when we look at innovation, I think one of our greatest failures really took place just a couple of years ago when we kind of made a decision to take existing revenue streams and drive for efficiencies. And the result of that was that our customer service to consumers suffered rather greatly. So we really took our eye off the ball. I think along those lines, as we were talking earlier, a great innovation that our people came about, they took an invention that was already in place. And the invention was the ability for technicians to take over people's systems, which is done in large corporations today, and take that invention and try to innovate on the very large scale. So the tool our people came up with, we call it Dell Connect. And over the past 60 days, we have conducted 1 million live sessions where we remotely take over consumers' PCs to address their tech support needs. So I think in our case, we really let efficiency and revenue streams get in the way of innovation. And as a result of that, we suffered. We're trying to take corrective actions today through innovation, such as this tool, Dell Connect, to get back to where we think we should be, which is taking care of the customer first.
That's very, very exciting. Yeah. And you, Don, I mean, do you guys look at the customers and how you had it?
I think the energy business, it's interesting in the sense if you think of this global supply chain of molecules, what many people would view, people in the audience, as individual customers are kind of at the very, very end of the system. The vast majority of customers, if you'd argue about it, are in the supply chain management. And so customers drive the system, drive the innovation system everywhere, except in many cases they don't look like
our
traditional customers. I mean, right. A customer might be, for example, a government that wants to develop a resource.
Uh-huh.
And your job then is to make that work for them. That's a different kind of customer that people normally deal with.
Yeah. And I remember years and years and years ago buying a Harman system myself. So you guys dealt directly with customers. I knew you, obviously your end user product is directly for customers and automobiles. How do you get input and feedback, and is that an important consideration?
Well, Jerry, one of the qualities of you that I have found admirable is that beyond making money, you've had a profound interest in Shakespeare. that speaks very well of you. You ask about the role of the customer. My view, and long held, has been that there's a relationship between the technology and the marketplace that is too often ignored, and that is that those who do the marketing really ought to be anthropologists. Chris has commented on the fact that Google has the smartest people in the world. Some of the smartest people.
That's we try and find them. So we're in a constant pursuit.
The notion that any company providing a product or service ought to start with a customer, it seems to me, is so fundamental and so often ignored. And certainly in our industry, the tyranny of the technology has been observed so very frequently. That is, the willingness on the part of the management of a company to permit the engineers to make whatever it is that they particularly enjoy making, irrespective of whether it has any particular resonance with the customer. Finding that appropriate equilibrium between the technology on the one hand and what I think of as the anthropology of the marketplace on the other, that's crucial.
I know, John, at Xerox, you guys had some interesting efforts. You've known as a great innovator, although other companies took your innovations and made a lot of money with them, Apple Computer being one of them.
Oh, are they still around?
So tell me tell me about some of the greatest failures you guys had and maybe even a great success at Xerox.
Well, to me, kind of an eye-opening event and one of my greatest initial failures was not understanding what you might call the architecture of revenue of the company, if you wish. And we had decided to invent world's most amazing copier, because that was the business Xerox was in. And so we did something that was beyond magic. We built a copier that you drop in a 30-page document, and it would summarize it into one page. And it didn't. It was independent of the language.
Wow.
So any language, preferably Indo-European, but also some of the Asian languages, you drop in this document and out would come one page. Mm. So, you know, I took this invention to Xerox corporate headquarters, and I was so proud. You know, and I met all the corporate officers, and I showed this invention, and the room was quiet. And finally I said, well, guys, are you so thunderstruck by this brilliance? And they said, somebody raised his hand and said, well, John, how do we make money? And I said, well, I never thought about that much.
So a copier which summarizes may be a great implementation of the Shakespeare line, brevity is the soul of wit, but it's not so great for revenue.
Well, especially if you make revenue off of toner. So, So somebody said, John, you just cut our annuity stream by 97%, and you want us to stand up and cheer you? That's a wow, wow idea, but it's really bad.
Yeah.
So this is kind of to get back. I said, oh, I got to just show you how it works. And so I picked up a corporate memo sitting by, and I said, let me put this corporate memo through this copier. And I had it arranged so it came out blank.
There's some merit there.
I know. But, you know, but after this terrifying, sobering experience, you know, it turned out that was a fundamental base to kind of turn things around a little bit. And we actually said, well, if we can do the summarization, we can also do document dry cleaning. We can clean up the stuff on the page. And we then invented a whole series of copiers whose copies were better than the original.
Didn't you guys want to be innovators in creating the paperless office, too?
Well, we talked about that last night at the Jerome, and the park was set up in order to look at the one Achilles heel that Xerox, the copier company, would have, which, of course, was a paperless office.
Uh-huh.
So we set out to do that, and part of that had led to kind of the invention of the PC networking, but more importantly, bitmap graphics, so you can have beautiful graphics on your screen. The trouble is you can't print graphics with a chain printer, which was the printers you had in 1970.
Right.
So in order to kind of have a balance, you had to create and invent a new kind of printer that goes along with a new kind of screen. So we invented a laser printer. And ever after, since the invention of laser printers, by the way, these laser printers we actually build are about half the size of this stage here that turn out a book, by the way, every minute.
Wow.
But ever since that, we've guaranteed there will probably always be paper in the office.
That's great. All right.
So we destroyed the initial mission.
That's great. How about you, Chris?
In terms of failure?
Google hasn't failed a whole lot these days. Everything seems to comes up right, although there's many little failures we don't hear about, right?
No, I'd say we actually fail every day. And it's weird. I don't think the public has a taste for it either, a tolerance for it. So
right.
I think they expect everything we do to be a home run. But our culture is a Clay Christensen innovator's dilemma culture, where we launch early, we launch often. We keep a central projects database, because anyone at Google can start a project. In fact, our engineers are required to spend 20% of their time working on something other than their actual job.
Mm.
And so at any given time, I think last I checked, we had 2,100 pending projects going on at Google right now.
Yeah.
So not all of those are going to launch, and certainly of those that launch, not all of those are going to be widely accepted. But when you go to Google right now and you click on the More tab and you see all the things we've launched, some of them are great successes and are really exciting, and people develop really great bonds with those products, and others of them just aren't that well loved and kind of die on the vine. But but it's interesting for us, though. We as an engineering culture want to preserve the kind of environment where we can launch these things and let users be the arbiters for what they like and what they want to use, and give us that feedback loop. You ask about customer feedback. We get somewhere between 450 million and 600 million customer feedback data points a day, right? So every time a user comes to the site, we actually learn a lot about what they're liking, what they're not. That said, when we start supplanting our choice in lieu of that end user choice, we end up with very perverse results and bad products. So, but it's interesting. The popular press, though, wants to expect each new thing to be a hit. And when we put out something that's only used by 10 or 15 million people, then it's a big disappointment.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about culture for a second. I'd like to ask the question to the panelists. Do you differentiate within your culture, have a separate definitions for innovation and invention? I mean, when I ask a person I think is a smart person about it, they said, well, innovation is like talent and invention is genius. That was their view of it. I think it's broader than that. I think it's more specific to unique cultures. And each of you guys come from different cultures. Can you, maybe you, Ro, start off with what? How you
Yeah, and let me, if I could go back 13 years when I joined Dell.
Right.
The company was barely over $1 billion in revenue. Today we're 60. At that time, we were in trouble. We had just gotten out of the notebook business. We had no cash. And it was a company in trouble. And I think at that point, we realized the difference between inventions and innovations. We had tried to invent. After driving the direct model for many, many years, we tried to invent and failed to realize the power of invention in others. So what we began to do is what we call virtual integration. So rather than invent the next great microprocessor, there were companies like Intel and AMD that could do that. So our role, really, in where our culture began to form, was one where take all these great inventions and innovate to provide customer value.
Right.
And, of late, we entered in a partnership with Google. It made a lot of sense. Like Google, we have personal interactions with 3 million customers a day. Last year, 180 million individual customers came to our site.
Yeah.
Last Friday, there were 39 million individual page views into Dell.com. So we have great data, and we use that data to innovate by leveraging inventions in the industries and virtually integrating what we do to bring products and services that matter.
Hey, innovation doesn't have to be the next new amazing technical gadget. In fact, I remember speaking to an executive from Compaq back in the early 90s saying, I don't see how Dell's going to compete with this. They have this mail order business. They go back 100 years with those guys. We have a fantastic retail channel, and what he didn't take into account was the retailers, by definition, have to keep the information about the customers for themselves. They don't want to share it with the manufacturer. And because he had the mail order list, he had direct information on what people wanted.
You know, if I could just make one example on John's point on the printing business earlier today. You know, yeah. We got into the printer business 3 years ago. Anybody here own a Dell printer by any chance? A couple of you do.
Yeah.
And what we found was that the biggest issue for customers.
Yeah, but
customers,
he invented it, by the way.
He did. The biggest issue for customers
laser one.
Was the replenishment of ink and toner.
Yeah.
So the innovation that our people came up with was that our printers, okay, would let them know when they're about to run out of ink. And in two clicks, they would order, and 99% of the time, the ink is shipped the same day to them. That's innovation.
Well, that's
we sold 10 million printers. Today, we're shipping about 19,000 cartridges a day, and it's a very growing business, all because of some great inventions over time that were innovated by our people to provide very value to consumers. Yeah.
Don, do you guys differentiate? I mean, you guys.
Yeah, I guess that formally you would look at the whole business as requiring continuous innovation to improve performance in the kind of processes that we use.
Yeah.
I kind of view invention as something that goes back to fundamental advances in understanding or scientific or technical knowledge that creates platforms on which subsequent innovations could occur.
Right.
Probably in our business. Some of the most important ones might be, and this goes back way back into the 30s when people really first began understanding surface chemistry and therefore catalysis. Catalysis is the ability to add. It's at the root of all fuel making, and it's really the first nanoscience, but it's the nanoscale chemistry. The ability to change to a new class of surface chemistry would create a whole platform of things you could do. Mm-hmm. So in our view, inventions and things like that tend to be events that shift the underpinnings on which continuous innovation continues.
That's great. John, you want to talk?
Let me build on that in a moment in a couple of ways. I think that, you know, we haven't talked really why this game is different today. And it's different today because the speed of innovation and invention has really accelerated because I'm going to claim the use of computation.
Yeah.
So, you know, in the old days, it would take 1,000 researchers in almost a national lab to do what you just said.
That's right.
You know, today, I can show you the exact same thing happening in a garage in Silicon Valley with 18 scientists that use over-the-network electron microscopes and all this kind of stuff to be able to get access to instrumentation. So we've taken problems that used to be requiring huge laboratories, now finding ways to do it in a distributed way and so on. So it's very interesting how computation has enabled us to now almost do what I'm going to call ab initio design rather than a lot of combinatorial design. And this is really radicalizing kind of the nano efforts on the one hand. But computation, on the other hand, is building these new types of platforms. And you talk about Google. Let me just briefly mention Amazon. You know, and likewise, yours depends on a kind of a platform of innovation. You know, Jeff at Amazon has a very simple rule, kind of like yours, that says
Jeff Bezos,
that he wants no innovation done that takes more than 6 months, approximately, that can be fed by two pizzas. We call it the two pizza team rule. Okay.
I think it's one pizza too many, by the way.
We'll debate that the next seminar.
Also have to worry about bricks and mortar.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah.
But if, in fact, an innovation takes more than that, that's a flaw in the platform. So then they go back and change the platform.
Okay.
So the whole catch is, how do you put enough power into the platform so that any idea that has to do with a service to the customer can be done very quickly by a very small team?
Well, let's define a platform real quick. Is that a contextual sort of understanding by a group of people that there's something here to do something with?
No, the platforms I was just talking about, and you were talking about more, is massive computational platforms that enable, it's kind of like we call the Web 2.0 kind of mentality, that takes tens of thousands of computers all strung together to be able to implement.
So it's math-based.
It's math and service. I mean, it's kind of a service-oriented architecture basis that enables you then.
Searching for oil, new sources of oil, has a lot of math involved in trying to identify, correct?
Lots. In fact, as an industrial activity, oil and gas uses more computing than any other.
Right.
We manage thousands of terabytes continuously. But What I meant by a platform was more, it's in a sense, it's kind of a metaphor, but it involves advances.
Yeah, it's not offshore
it's a combination of, no, it's not a physical thing. It's a combination of organizational capability, fundamental science, supporting infrastructure and technology. But it's the combination of all of those things that allow you to introduce fundamental shifts, in our case, in the processes.
Right.
And, you know, and if you think about it, I think back to computing. You know, we were talking about that on our ride over. We actually used to build analog computers well before digital computers in order to try to, crudely, but nonetheless, simulate fluid flow. We actually used to actually build them.
So you're the high-tech company of the last century, basically.
We used to build digital. We had laser plotters because of the data we had to plot built in the 50s.
Okay. So why should any of us in the audience care about innovation? I mean, if we're shareholders, why do we care about it, what you guys are doing?
If you can't improve whatever your business performance parameters are, volume, cost, capital efficiency, I don't care what it is, there's a set of innovation drivers that will drive performance in that. And understanding what they are is probably the key to putting innovation in your organization in context.
Sid?
We're living in a remarkably new world. This digital world is a totally different world.
Right.
Yet it seems to me useful to step back just a moment and consider one of the fundamentals in innovation. I remember a time, good numbers of years ago, when I was very much involved with an experimental college. And in the pursuit of my responsibilities then, I was traveling through the country, stopped at a farmhouse in rural Georgia just to use the facilities, and as I came out, saw this wizened old farmer sitting on the porch whittling the most remarkably lovely flying horses, whittling them out of a broomstick. And as his hand flashed over that broomstick, I was deeply moved by what he was producing. I turned to him and asked him, "Do you have any idea what magic you're producing here?" And his response was, "Sonny, all's I do is whittle away everything that ain't hoss." I find in that a lesson about the world in which we live that's really quite profound. Our job in terms of innovation, whether it's with respect to product or organization, is to whittle away everything that isn't relevant. In the end, innovation, I'd suggest, is nothing less than the devolving of the complex into the sublime.
Well, that's beautifully said, but, you know, it's interesting because we're all, I don't know about you guys, but I have a wireless thing. I don't know all the features on this. The engineers have kind of over-featured me in a lot of things. Too much innovation in my PC, in my little portable communicating device. What are you guys doing? I mean, there's more stuff there than I know how to deal with. how do we manage that?
This is one of the major challenges. I would say if you were to ask what is our primary technical challenge spanning all things we do, it's this whole question of redefining, I guess, what we would call the human-digital relationship. The amount of data is rising so much faster than it can, in our case, doubling every 2-3 months. People simply cannot deal with it. And so I think the real challenge of the future is developing the underlying technologies that are going to allow for the system, quite frankly, to manage itself perfectly well without very many humans in it. This is going to be the challenge for us, that a world in which most of the digital communication is machines to machines.
So more machines.
Things running, things taking data. Universal digitization and connectivity is going to have to drive to a world in which the way in which humans react in the digital environment is going to have to be significantly different, because I think we're best about maxed out on
John, besides your very, you have a lot of passion around learning and knowledge. How are we going to keep up with this? And then I want to go to you, Chris, and
right.
tell us what you guys are planning over Google.
I'll tell you all the secrets. Don't worry.
Even how many computers you're having. I'm really struck by two things. One, you're absolutely right. Most of the data today is machines talking to machines, and how do you really make that work? But the catch is, as we get overwhelmed by data, both in your business and the intelligence business as well, one of the questions is how to redefine the relationship between people and machines in terms of making it much more visual. And so, we are fantastically good at picking up visual patterns, and by the way, auditory patterns. So you can actually bring both of those senses and modalities into play in these truly immersive rooms that you can start to walk into proteins or folding and some of the kinds of things. It's not the total solution, but that is not a very visual interface, actually. Mm-hmm. So I think that's the key. But I want to say one other thing. I want to build on your point, Sydney, because I think that... It's very hard, again, for me to have come to recognize as chief scientist that there is big bang innovation and then there is rapid incremental innovation. Mm-hmm. And in the West, we have tended to worship big bang innovation. And yet most of the real differences are made by actually rapid, accelerated, incremental innovation. And so the question is, how do you accelerate the learning loop in terms of finding out new things about the customers and so on and so forth? So if you look at, for example, why is Toyota killing American cars manufacturers? It's because they have mastered, by the way, exactly, they would say the exact same thing you just said. We've got to whittle away the waste. They even have a word for it. Okay, and so they are constantly, every day, running honest-to-God scientific experiments everywhere on the line. And whittling away the waste. And they are accelerating in their ability to do that. And so we have to think about how do we accelerate the loop of innovation, and I think that that's a lot of things that are now happening.
Well, that's interesting. Chris, before I get to you, one of the things we think about in history, the Renaissance, which took place over a couple of hundred-year period, was a huge period of innovation and took a couple of hundred years to get out those innovations. Now it seems that innovation is in weeks to months. What's happening at Google, and how do you look at time relative to innovation, and what are the sort of values?
Well, I think the innovative scale at Google happens in terms of hours. So
right.
Most of our major products we re-release every 24 hours, sometimes more quickly than that. So it's the luxury of not having to build stuff into an OEM and not having to really plan long life cycles. We can go ahead and relaunch. So we have products like Google Video, which in 18 months has had 9 very distinct lives, where it has changed course multiple times based on customer feedback. I mean, to the platform question, it's interesting to me because I like to quote, since 1982, which happens to be the year in which the average Google engineer was born, computing power has increased, the power of the CPU has increased by 3,600 times.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And the value you get when buying disk, so your dollar goes 3.7 million times further when you're buying disk space. And so... our CEO likes to say if you eke that kind of efficiency out of a gallon of gas, you could circumnavigate the globe 2,172 times.
Right.
So these guys are working on that,
I guess for Google, acne is a big problem you have to worry about.
Yeah.
You didn't need a new answer.
I keep those numbers confidential, but yeah.
Sure.
So it's become increasingly easier to gather this data, to process it, and yet that layer of intelligence that helps us filter the best answer to the top requires more and more innovation at this point. But that said, I do think it's really important underlying all this to have a culture which incents this rapid innovation. I've hired many, many people from a large software company up in the Pacific Northwest who all say the same two things.
Yeah.
I've never worked on a team smaller than 200 or 250 people, and I haven't launched squat in 4 years. And so when we bring them into our environment and they work on teams that can be fed with one pizza and maybe there's something left over, and their product goes from concept to launch within 3-4 months, it's fascinating to see them blossom. It's like rediscovering their creative roots all over again.
Right. So Sydney, and then you wrote.
I wanted to build on what both Chris and John have said. One of the beauties of Google, and I don't think that it's irrelevant to its enormous commercial success, is the fact that the founders believe that they have a profound civic responsibility, and they communicate that point of view throughout the organization. It is remarkable to me how many companies making their living in the digital world run their companies in absolute analog fashion. They are t- top-down, authoritative. There is very little of the interdisciplinary engagement that you speak to. And that anomaly is absolutely astonishing. In the end, I'm convinced that it's going to separate the winners and the losers.
Well, that's a great segue into culture. Okay, so what's the culture at Dell and this sort of, you know, how do you guys allow for innovation, particularly if you have to move decisions up to, you know, in a hierarchical structure?
Yeah, Jerry, we're struggling with that right now. I mean, we've gone from a company that was once the hunter to one that today is the hunted in our space. With size and scale becomes the growth of processes have become a hindrance to innovation for us. So we're struggling today. I think the culture is there, but we haven't found a way to move as fast as we once did. As we did, you know, when we were 6, 7, 8, 9 years old, you know, as Google is today. And that's a struggle for us. I think the culture is there for us to go do that, but we're just not unable to move as fast as we could. I think the second point that I wanted to make is that change in our industry happens so fast. And today, being in 180 countries, dealing with languages, cultures, we are at a point where we're transitioning into the next phase of our company. So while the culture is there, I don't know that we have figured out how to truly move as fast as we want.
But the culture has changed over time. You guys have managed growth in a way that is envious of most corporations around the world, and you have evolved it over time. I mean, I remember two of my advisors used to run Goldman Sachs in 1988. It was not a trivial argument at Goldman Sachs whether to take a 22-year-old kid public, and that kid was Michael Dell. And it was a big issue. We risk our reputation on a 22-year-old kid, and I think they're happy they did. It succeeded well.
Yeah, the culture has changed, but I think at its core, it really hasn't.
Okay.
And the core of the culture is really innovation for customer's sake. And what I'm saying, Jerry, is that today we're struggling with our size and our complexity and our ability to move fast. I think in our case, maybe it takes 3 pizzas. Mm-hmm. And we got to get down to 2 and eventually to 1 to move faster than we did.
John, you've done a lot of work in organizations. What kind of unique cultural attributes do you see for fast-moving learning and fast-moving innovation? What do companies have to do? What do companies have to do if you were advising them, hey, what do you got to do to be quicker, faster, better?
Besides coming to the Aspen Ideas Festival?
Yeah. And by the way, Rupert Murdoch said something great. He said that, today's world, it's not about big companies beating small companies, it's about fast companies beating slow companies. And I think he had something right that fits the time.
In some sense, less can be more.
Yeah, exactly
because
right.
Of the, yeah.
Exactly.
I mean, I think the key thing is the culture of the company really love new ideas, or are they afraid of new ideas?
Yeah.
Can they embrace new ideas, and can they, going back to your comment, can they see the aesthetics of a new idea as well as the technologies of the new idea? And it's kind of, again, the balance. I mean, it's very interesting that, you know, in our research center, the number of artists we actually employ.
Yeah.
Because it's the interaction between art and science and art and design that really kind of keeps the imagination in play, so to speak. Mm. So there's a sense full of, and this sounds very strange to Wall Street, but you see it tremendously in Google, is how playful is the culture? Can
right.
I play? Am I allowed to play with an idea even in a meeting?
Right.
And this could be a new type of supply chain arrangement. It's a playful idea if you think about it right.
Yeah. Before I get to Google and Don on this question, I think how do human beings need structure? Do human beings need leaders? You know, last year at the Ideas Festival, we had Jane Goodall, and she talked about, you know, in the jungle, the chimpanzees, if the alpha male and the alpha female are removed from the situation, the monkeys go crazy. They can't organize themselves. So tell me about Google. Are you guys able to sort of grow and innovate as a flat structure mostly, or do you have your alpha male, female people that are driving change?
We end up being an intensely flat structure, and it's unnerving sometimes.
Yeah.
And it's very bottoms up. I think people regularly appeal to Eric, Larry, and Sergey in the day and say, solve this problem for us. And they wisely resist and stay laissez-faire to let groups go ahead and solve it for themselves because they feel like bigger stakeholders. I think, you know, it's been interesting for me. I've been paying attention to the music industry lately. And as I meet people in the music industry, which is by all accounts just broken, I'll get somebody's name and I'll look them up on the internet or Google them, I guess. And I'm sure my trademark lawyers wouldn't be psyched about that. But So I looked them up, and sure enough, and I dare any of you to do this, you will find that every single press release in which their name is mentioned, within six words, will mention who they report directly to. Try it. Just find anyone in the entertainment industry. You'll see their name, and then six words later, it's just who they report to.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. It's how they define themselves within this hierarchy. It's who do you work for? Not what have you done, what have you built, what have you launched. It's who do you work for?
Yeah.
So, in our company, I don't know if anyone on the side that's actually building stuff is more than 3 degrees removed from Larry and Sergey. But the key to that, then, is you have to have a peer-reinforced culture. And a peer-reinforced culture depends on a lot of transparency. So every single Friday at Google, you type in your snippets. That's what you've accomplished that week. Those snippets get broadcast into a database that's accessible by everyone else in the company. Anyone can click on your name and see everything you've accomplished over the last few weeks, what you plan to accomplish in the upcoming weeks. They can also see your objectives and key results, what you are going to objectively accomplish that quarter, and then how you've been scored by your peers on accomplishing those objectives. Everyone, from Larry and Sergey on down, the company does this. Every project has a page where anyone else in the company can come and see the state of that project, milestones, where they are, who's contributing.
So you have transparency and accountability built into the system without it necessarily having to be a human being.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be. I mean, ultimately, it doesn't scale. So Google was originally built around the idea that we give free breakfast, lunch, and dinner to our employees every day as a way of fostering that exchange between employees. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't necessarily scale when you have 6,000 or 7,000 people on a campus. And so you end up having to build tools that substitute or complement even the dinner table, where everyone used to be able to keep tabs and what are you working on, how can I help you, that kind of thing. So we still continue the food tradition. We have very long tables. So you're always sitting next to someone you don't know. And I think that's where innovation actually happens. Never discount the power of food.
So are you saying innovation requires a free lunch?
Well, we go one step even further. We have a 100-foot rule, so you're never more than 100 feet away from food at Google. And so...
And you stay pretty thin.
Yeah. Well, listen, we're actually running out of time. Just look at the watch. We've only got 6 minutes left. So I'd like to open up, if you don't mind, to some questions from the audience. Is anyone out there want to have a question? You, sir? Does government have a role in innovation in your companies at all? Yes, no.
I'll answer from ours. I think on a good place to start is a traditional role that that government has always had, particularly in the United States, which is supporting fundamental science and R&D.
That's great.
Investing in the things that change the underpinnings. I still think that's a critical role. Or in doing things with industry that require extraordinarily high risk and high investments.
I'd say for me, I have two frustrations. One is when government intervenes to block my access to talent. So it frustrates me a lot. The U.S. education system hasn't produced the scores of engineers that a company like ours needs, and we have to go outside the country to find them. And so I hate when I think a protectionist government inserts itself to artificially limit the ingress of people who would be wildly productive and contribute a lot to our culture and our economy. And second is, I've had recent experiences in government with trying to build Wi-Fi networks. I proposed to build one in Mountain View, the small town where Google's headquartered.
This is a free wireless network for people to get access to data and voice.
Yeah, really no downside, all upside, right? So introducing a competitive element so that you have free internet access, and at its best, you save some money, you know, and it kind of pokes a competitive jab at the telcos. But I proposed this to San Francisco 2 years ago. And we're now just having our first committee meetings. So this is technology that I was about, to, you know, that I was willing to go ahead and build and give the entire $15 million network to the city of San Francisco for a dollar. But we're still in committees, including an aesthetic committee that's going to rule on what these radios look like, et cetera. Whereas in the city of Mountain View, I found a community that was willing to embrace it. The whole process took about 8 weeks with the city, and the network's up and running now.
Great.
I think I understand the concept of whittling. As a consumer, what it would mean to me is that I can buy a device that doesn't have 168 bells and whistles that I do not use, and that I inadvertently press the wrong button and can never get out of it or find what I want. I would love to be able to buy a device that has those features that I more or less want and know how to use and not have all the extra stuff that really gets in my way and makes me crazy.
Who wants to take that?
John, go ahead. That is precisely what I was referring to at the beginning of the hour when I spoke about beware of the tyranny of the technology. The job of the engineers, the job of the research and the development department is to be responsive precisely to that point of view. And those companies that do it well will succeed, and those who continue in the old mode will absolutely fail.
I think if I could just add, Jerry, what the gentleman described here is part of the process of paying almost too much attention to the revenue stream to monetize the interaction and adding, in our case, onto the PCs,
right,
lots of icons and programs and things that you'll never use. We recognize that, realize that, and I think you'll be pleased over time as we simplify the offering and make it a lot less busy and a lot more usable for people like you. I think you're absolutely right on. And
you know, we used to get an email every day from the same user that contained a number, nothing else, no explanation, nothing. It was a number, and it would say 22, 24, 18, 22, and it took 6 months to figure out what this was. And ultimately, because we had some really bright people who love puzzles, they figured out this was a user who was counting the number of words on the front page every day and just sending it to us as a reminder that we needed to keep the simplest front page on the Internet out there.
That's great. Okay, so I think you were there, and then...
My question has to do, in the topic, the word globalization was in the topic of the conversation.
Yeah.
And what I wanted to ask is, in your process of going to the user and technology, what influence do foreign cultures, Chinese, Indian, African, have on the design, both technologically and on its appearance? Because I know there have been business failures in the past where something was very functional, but it had the wrong design, and it was culturally offensive, and so consequently people never used it.
Can I say two things about
sure.
that? Because we've it's funny. When we originally built the site, it was widely embraced across the world. And its simplicity, by the way, wasn't intentional. It was just because Larry and Sergey didn't know how to code HTML, so they maybe would have made a more complex site. But we learned a couple things. Number one is that the simplicity is not universally well regarded. So in Korea, for instance, we've done a lot of user studies. We don't do very well in Korea. And we've started asking people, why don't we do very well? And they see our very simple site without any graphics infused, without any bouncing in motion, as a sign that we're not talented enough to create a page like that. And so they see us as literally unskilled.
Boring.
And so it, beyond that we don't even have the technical capability to make those bouncing monkeys and stuff that you have to punch. And it's strange. It's a very wide cultural gap. So throughout Africa, throughout Latin America, throughout Europe, they have that same ethos that really embraces the simple page, and yet it doesn't resonate in Korea. But that said, we learned a lesson recently in developing mobile apps, and that's why I got this out. We learned, and this is completely based on empiricals, that if you want your mobile app to be used in China, it has to be accessible by one thumb, because the other hand is always smoking. Right. And so again, not stereotyping, empirical data. So you can't build something that requires a two-handed keystroke. It has to be operable by one thumb, or it won't work.
That's interesting. That's great.
If I could just add a personal experience here, I immigrated from Ecuador, South America, back in 1974. And as I did in Ecuador, every morning, twice a week, I would take the trash out. 2 weeks into my residence in the U.S., a policeman came to the door to ask him why we were putting trash in the mailbox in the corner. you see, in Ecuador, where I lived, trash cans were blue, and they were in the corner of every city. We've always recognized that cultures and customs play a big role in how we go to market. But in our case, we actually don't. In our case, you know, our model is really the essence of what we do of innovation. It's a direct model. So we have often gone into other cultures, other countries, and found a real difficult time. In Japan, it took us 8 years to make a profit. A real difficult time culturally. And when we try to change to adapt to the culture, we failed. It really wasn't until we began executing the core elements of our strategy that we began to be successful. So in our case, it's somewhat of a different approach to things. We do recognize the cultural, the global issues that we deal with, but we have our success has been based on staying true to our model and ultimately driving the benefits that the core elements of the model do provide.
And we're going to have to cut this off here pretty quick. So if you could be very brief, and one over here real brief, okay? And we'll try and get you all in, but let's do it quick.
One of the themes has been speed, fast, turning around innovations in a matter of hours or weeks. In our organization, we struggle between that and, on the other hand, taking a problem, thinking it through, sleeping on it, asking other people, maybe testing it. So can you talk a little bit about that that balance?
I think I mentioned in our business, for example, we really have all these time scales. I mean, the last thing I want is someone who's running a high-pressure sour gas plant changing the system every 3 hours. That's probably not a good concept, okay? On the other hand, if you're talking about some areas where you really got people constantly working on this user interface issue to interfacing control system, you want lots of invention, lots of turn. So I think it depends on what it is you're doing, how long it's going to last, what's the scale of the impact. So it comes back to innovation in context is the way I would put it. So there are things where I think it's a good idea for somebody to think about it for a while.
Great.
Before you make a commitment that you are really sorry you did.
We say one thing. We say hypotheses are cool, data are cooler.
Okay. Go ahead.
And my question is on globalization, because we saw and The Economist talked to us about the productivity and how much that in the future is innovation and productivity is key to our growth and our maintaining our standards. None of you talked about the ills of education or anything relating to that would get in the way globalization. Competitization that would get in the way of your ability to innovate over the next few years. Could any of you just briefly comment? Is there any areas that significantly worry you that would impede your ability to innovate?
Well, I would suggest that the greatest concern, in the most general terms, is the growing devotion to specialization. The narrow disciplines that the people we look to for innovative thinking engage in. There is enormous value in multidisciplined engagements, not just by organizations and groups, but by individuals. Encouraging engineers to know something about marketing, encouraging all the key people in a company to think in the poetic terms, if you will, that some of our greatest scientists have. Einstein, a magnificent example of it. That's the material that will lubricate innovation, and the absence of it is the material that will cause it to decline.
Let me get this last question, because we're out of time. So please go ahead.
This sort of dovetails on the education question. Has, as an industry, you all considered knowing that you're not home-growing the kind of talent that you want at this point? When you were talking about importing people. As an industry, have you considered how to do something that is going to be able to encourage the public education system to be more innovative and to try to change what's going on in our school systems, that you're going to be able to develop the best and the brightest that we have to offer? I know the Gates Foundation did something with the New York system that has changed a great deal. I know you're all good community citizens and you do a lot of community good in your individual areas, but I wondered if collectively you come together and maybe from the bottom up tried to do something for
the
system.
Yeah, this will be the last question. We're going to wrap it up. So you want to tackle that?
Our mission statement is to organize all the world's information, make it universally accessible and useful. And we hearken back to that in every decision we make. So we certainly have tried to build the world's most robust and resilient and growing research tool out there. But we realize that the devices don't necessarily exist to access it around the world, and the network connectivity isn't there to access it around the world. So we've started projects to go ahead and try and proliferate better access through the connectivity stuff. We're founding partners on the One Laptop Per Child initiative.
Great.
To try and seed more cheap devices. And then we seeded $1 billion into a foundation to try and push some of these agendas as well.
That's great. Don? But
I think ultimately, though, education is part of engaging people who are involved in that enterprise. There's an enormous human interaction component to education that makes it work. We were involved with LA Schools, the second biggest school system in the United States, in training basically a third of all the science teachers in earth science. That was an example. But I think this, what you have to do is you got to be committed. This is going to take you 20 or 30 years. This is not something that's going
to
happen
tomorrow. You have to have a long view.
Long view, direct engagement, and I think one of the best ways to engage it is have your employees do it and do it at scale.
Great.
Employees, retirees.
Ro, you want the last word?
No, I don't think as an industry we have done, to answer your question, no, we haven't. I think we all have done things individually, and I think you raise an issue that we just haven't addressed.
Great. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm.